And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usery, and I'm happy to welcome Robert Gordon back to the program today. Robert is a documentary filmmaker and writer. His most well-known film is Best of Enemies, about the series of debates between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley in the late 60s. His many books include The Biography of Muddy Waters, Can't Be Satisfied, and Respect Yourself, A History of Stax Records. Today we'll be talking about his new book, Memphis Rent Party, The Blues, Rock, and Soul in Music's Hometown, a collection of his previous writings about some of the lesser-known but still massively talented musicians who are from or came to Memphis. Now, Robert, I remember reading about 20 years ago, and it might have been something you wrote yourself, but I haven't been able to find it since, that back in the vaudeville days, there was a saying, there's only three times you don't play, on Christmas, on Easter, and in Memphis.
Wow. Now, that definitely wasn't written by me. I've never heard that. I hate to hear it, although it seems true. I mean, being raised here, it's like all the acts would pass us by and hit Nashville, and we'd go, wait a minute, you know, why don't you play here?
But it also seems like for Memphis being a place known for its music, that we haven't treated our musicians very well either.
Well, that's true. Didn't the TOBA, the T-O-B-A, Theater Owner Bookers Association or something, begin here, which people in the Chitlin Circuit called T-O-B-A, tough on black asses. So, it's true. Memphis has not been kind to its musical heritage, only since the musical heritage started to die off and Memphis realized there was an economic interest. When Elvis died and everyone came to town and the city fathers saw that there was green in the blues, there was money in it, then the city began to appreciate its musical heritage, or began to, didn't appreciate its musical heritage, but it appreciated what its musical heritage could bring them.
Over the past year, it seems like the Guardian newspaper out of England has had an axe to grind against Elvis, and they're always talking about how his memorabilia sales are going down and everything like that. I was just wondering if you'd kept up with that at all.
What I see more from the Guardian, it's funny because their stuff circulates on social media a good bit, and I see that they're doing really interesting articles. I haven't noticed the axe to grind. The ones I've caught have been, you know, that they're paying attention where lots of people don't pay attention.
They had it out for Elvis memorabilia there for a little while last year. Now, it seems that most of the subjects in the book are not in a good place in regards to fame. Either they're trying to get what they used to have, or they're overwhelmed by what they do have. Was that a conscious idea to have that kind of fighting with fame throughout the book?
Well, no, not a conscious idea, but I think it's like if you're writing about Memphis and you're going to not write about the hits, you know, if you're not going to write about Elvis, you're not going to write about Al Green. Pretty quickly, you know, you get into people who once were or wanted to be or should have been. The list of stars is actually pretty, it's a quite a long roster. But I think it's interesting, the true believers, Charlie Feathers, you know, when you think of rockabilly, you think of Elvis, maybe you think of Carl Perkins, maybe, but Charlie Feathers tends to be on down the list. But Charlie Feathers lived longer than most of the others, kept to his original sound and worked wildly within that sound. You know, he was a real experimenter within his genre. And so I think that it's sort of natural that the people who were trying the most interesting stuff became the least known. Because it's the Sam Phillips frame of mind in a way. Fame wants you to sound like anybody can sound, right? Fame wants you to be singing along in the shower, humming the radio commercial. But Sam Phillips said, I don't want you to sound like anybody can sound. I want you to sound like only you can sound. And that is going to hit really big sometimes, like Elvis, or it's going to create a distinctly unique persona like Howlin' Wolf.
Here's my Charlie Feathers story.
Good. Lay it on me.
It's nothing personal, but I'd moved to Germany with the woman who became my ex-wife, and Johnny Cash did a concert in the middle of the Saturday afternoon, and they would, for big acts like that, they would have theme parties at night at clubs around town, and they asked me to DJ the party at Große Freiheit, where the Beatles played back in the day.
Oh, cool.
Große Freiheit 36. They had some German country bands playing there. And so in between sets, I'd spin records. And when Charlie Feathers had that record come out on the American Explorer series.
Yeah, right.
I played a couple of those tracks. And this kid that was in one of the bands ran up, and his name was Deutschmark Bob. But he was actually from Louisiana. And he's going, you play Charlie Feathers. You play Charlie Feathers. And so, I mean, he was so excited to have heard Charlie Feathers.
It's true, but that's the way it is, because Charlie Feathers has a distinct sound, and people who know it are bowled over by it. I mean, I think Charlie's one of the, one of the greatest voices ever. What he can do with his voice, the manipulations and the silkiness that stays with it, unless he doesn't want the silkiness. I mean, it's really versatile. And that American Explorers record is the one that I covered him on in the, that my article with him is about.
That was a great series, the Jimmy Dale Gilmore record that came on. That was
all
great.
Of them, man.
Was it Johnny Johnson had the piano?
Yeah. Sid Selvage had a record. And there was a fifth one, I think a Louisiana or a Texas guy, I've forgotten.
That was about the time the Robert Johnson box set had come out, too, right there at the beginning of the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Well, I covered that Robert Johnson box set, too. That's another one of the essays in the book. And there in the canon of Robert Johnson material, I think what makes my piece different is it covers the legend and the myth and all that, and it covers the music. But what it does is keeps an eye on the money. How'd the money flow here? So you get everything, told well, but you also get a look at how musicians are exploited when they're alive and when they're dead.
Tell us about LeVere and that other fellow that had claims
to... Mac McCormick.
Yeah.
CBS Records, Columbia Records in the early 60s, probably like 60 or 61, put out Robert Johnson, King of the Blues, an LP of about a dozen of his songs. And prior to that, he hadn't been available since the original 78s. And it really took off. I mean, not like it did as a box set, but it created a stir. A guy named Mac McCormick from Houston, Texas, was a folklorist, did a lot of work with the Smithsonian, really dedicated, he was one of those guys who would sell insurance door to door just in order to meet people to ask if they had a record collection and could he come in and look at it. So he was looking for 78s and knew what he was looking for. And he did all kinds of work to do that. Side note, I just read a new book by Amanda Petrusich, not so new, Amanda Petrusich, Do Not Sell at Any Cost, I think it is, about 78 collectors. So it's interesting. That mindset was really interesting. So Mac, in his pursuit, went on a small AM radio station in Washington, D.C., saying he was looking for Robert Johnson's sisters and got a lead that panned out. It led to his half-sister and his stepsister. From the two of them, he got the photographs, and he began, and he got some information. And then this other guy, Steve LeVere, who came not from like the folklore background, but more like the exploitation background of music, like taking talent and exploiting it. He kind of horned in on Mac's research, cut a new deal with Robert Johnson's sister, and claimed ownership. He cut a deal that was really kind of a devil's deal where she got $100 and an album that she didn't have a turntable to play it on. And Steve LeVere got publishing rights to all of Robert Johnson's songs, which is has proved to be worth millions of dollars. Carrie Thompson never got anything after that. Got $100 and that was that. And her family was among those. What it led to, these two conflicts and LeVere's ultimate success, led to a series of lawsuits by people who had an interest. And presumably it followed the law. The research led to an outside son who was accepted as blood relative, and he wound up getting all the money. And the people who had particular relationships or kinships to the material or to the photographs or to the recordings and the songs or the people who knew Robert Johnson, they didn't get anything.
Yeah, and it's also amazing to think that, say, like a young Eric Clapton is sitting in his bedsit listening to that early 60s release, and that was less than 25 years from the time they were recorded in 37 in Dallas, and now it's twice the time since.
Yeah, that's true. It is amazing. I mean, the Robert Johnson talent, both as a poet, a really great understanding of the blues form, the AAB form, say a line, repeat it, and then give a conclusion. And not all of his are like that, but all of his lyrics are very tight and concise. They reuse lyrics that came before him. One of my favorite records is called The Roots of Robert Johnson. I think it's on Yazoo or Shanaki or one of those collector's labels, but it gets all the songs that Robert Johnson based his songs on. So it wasn't like they were original compositions. And there's an argument to be made that consequently they shouldn't be quote unquote published. They shouldn't be, they should be public domain.
Traditional arranged by.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, great, massive talent. It's not surprising that, you know, every time the Robert Johnson stuff was released to a new generation, it sold well because it's gripping.
And that was a new era, post-World War I, we'll say, in which popular music performance, not just songs had been passed down, but the actual performances were able to record it and survive to some,
changes everything.
To some point in the future. And now with almost everything being available instantaneously and going after 78s.
I'm not a collector, you know. I don't get the pursuit. I mean,
well, I mean, you want to find something that no one else has, but it seems like that's such a difficult time nowadays with everything on Spotify.
And that's the other thing is that since it's, I just like to listen to it. You know, I like this to listen to things that please me, and it's so easy now. Yeah, my daughter and I were talking about whether to join Spotify or not. I still don't do it because I think that it kills the system. It kills the artist. Actually, the artist doesn't get their due. Now, you know, maybe it's Spotify's fault, maybe it's not. But as a producer of, you know, films and stuff, I'm aware that the maker of the content is constantly squeezed and the person distributing or owning the content really has the playroom. Now, I understand their market's changing too, but it seems like you got to give the maker a little respect. I'd rather buy the hard copy and own it and play it and know that a portion of that filtered down to the artist.
Yeah, I like to buy my CDs at shows so I know at least I'm giving them gas money.
Well done. I tip my hat.
Now, it seemed that the performer in the book that had the most consistent career was Bobby Blue Bland. What do you think musicians can learn from his example in the book?
How to dress. Because that was my coolest exchange with Bobby Bland was talking about
his socks.
I'm a fan of Bobby Bland's, and, you know, he's got this real suave, debonair persona vocally and the way he presents himself and everything.
But he had that grunt.
And he had that, he called it a squall. And then he said, but someone in England called it a love throat, and I can live with that. I was like, okay, Bobby, I like that love throat. It is like that sound he makes is the sound where the church and the bordello kind of intersect. It's a beautiful kind of weird sound he makes, and I've seen him do it live, and the audience is slayed every time he does it. So they insisted I meet him at the Peabody to do the interview. I thought that was really cool. I have always felt like music, the problem with music writing is it's about music, you know, whereas what I like is, what is music about? What is the artist about? What are the circumstances? What are the meanings, you know, more than just like how it sounds. And so I was really taken with how Bobby Bland dressed. And especially when I found out how poor he'd come up, and I realized how important it was to him to be dressed. And we're sitting there talking and there was a pause and I had to ask, man, can you wear, I forget how I phrase it. Can you wear brown socks with black slacks? No way. Never, Bobby said, you know, I can only wear, he said, my colors, he went right into it, man. My colors are blue, black, and
gray.
And gray. Yeah. And if I'm wearing blue slacks, I'm wearing blue socks. And then I asked him, I was like, well, where'd you get this? Like, who in your family, you know? And he talked about Uncle Dude, who would come down to visit. And the first memory he's got of Uncle Dude is a shirt with buttons that go not vertically up and down the chest, but slanted, like from the upper left to the lower right. That was the way it buttoned. And Bobby said, I was really impressed with that. And man, that tells you more about Bobby Bland's songs than Bobby Bland telling you what his songs are about.
Now, can you make any generalizations about artists who were born and raised in Memphis as opposed to those who moved to town later in life?
No, you know, I didn't think of it that way. I come back to like what attracts me to musicians from Memphis is the ones, or the musicians who came to Memphis or intersected with Memphis, is that pursuit of individuality, that pursuit of uniqueness. So someone like Towns Van Zandt, you know, there's like Towns in the book, Towns Van Zandt's in the book, and Cat Power, Jeff Buckley, people who came here.
Lead Belly.
Lead Belly's the most
On the outside
of
this.
He's in the book because I bought his LP at a record store in Memphis early in my formative years, and it really helped me learn a lot. It's an LP all a cappella. And it's just really what it is a field recording of him at Frederick Ramsey's dinner table in Washington, D.C. in the, I forget when, late 40s. It was not long before he died. So that's how Lead Belly fit in. But what unites the people in the book is that pursuit of individuality, sui generis kind of sound.
Yeah, it seemed like many of the younger musicians in the book really had a disdain for fame and its trappings, with Jeff Buckley and Cat Power, that they were very wary of what it could do to a person. So do you think Elvis had served as a good example to scare people?
Elvis is the example for everybody after Elvis, because that sort of, like you were talking about, in the post-war period, recordings began. So this kind of mass communication, you know, I remember when I was in college in the 80s, there were like mass communication departments. I was like, okay, I understand what that means, but not really. But with more perspective, I get it now that, you know, that was an era when 1 3-minute and 15-second moment in a recording studio could have, you know, untold effect on millions of people all over the world. And that kind of thing hadn't been possible prior to that. And it reached a peak in Elvis that even helped the Beatles, I think, understand, be a little more wary of fame. People like Frank Sinatra, there were stars, there were fans. Frank was really, you know, doing it across media already. But I think Elvis served as the example for everybody. And I think the wariness, I mean, really, imagine if the Betty Ford Center had been available to Elvis Presley, he might be alive. You know, there was no place where you couldn't, for Elvis to not be Elvis. And so Jeff came here to not be Jeff Buckley. Jeff Buckley in Greenwich Village was someone who was getting eaten alive. And Jeff Buckley in Memphis, Tennessee could put on a dress and walk down Madison Avenue and get Asian food and no one stopped him. And that was really cool. That's what he came for.
One person that kind of stands out, hardly anyone will know his name outside of town, and I hadn't certainly heard the story, was Jerry Magill. And what a frightening, fascinating story that is.
Yes. Now, that grew out of a documentary I made, you know, called Very Extremely Dangerous. I initially encountered Magill through video footage that the photographer William Eggleston shot and that I helped him make into a documentary called Stranded in Canton. He shot it in the mid-70s. We cut it in the mid-2000s, like 2005, I think. So, and Magill was this wild character, great on film, you know, great on the camera, but just really uncontrollable, almost killed people in the movie. And so then my friend and mentor, Jim Dickinson, had been telling me about Magill. They were old friends or old acquaintances, early rock and rollers in Memphis. When I was finishing Canton, I tried to put a end of movie credit for Magill, like these are what's happened to these people now. And I knew that Roland Jaynes, who ran Sam Phillips Recording Service, would sometimes get collect calls from Magill in the Florida prison. So I knew, and the internet was available by that point in time. So I spent a couple days going through Florida prison records trying to find Jerry Magill. When I finally met up with him about a decade after that, I found out the reason I couldn't find him in prison is because he was serving third prison term under an assumed name.
And worse, you gave him your home address.
Oh my God. It was, when he got out, he sent me some short stories. He found my book. It came from Memphis. Loved the way I wrote. He was a really smart guy. I mean, not just because he liked my writing, but you know, he was a reader. He sent me some short stories even before we'd talked, and they were great. And then we talked on the phone about, and we talked about, he was wanting to come up to Memphis. He was living in Alabama, come up and make some recordings. And we were talking about me coming in to film it. I talked about how good his stories were, and he said, well, give me your address. I'll send you some more. And it was like time stopped. For like 15 or 20 years, I had kept a P.O. box for just this kind of occasion when I needed to get something from someone who I didn't really want to give my home address to. And I thought, well, everybody says all these terrible things about Magill and his untrustworthiness, but he's in his 70s now. He's got to have calmed down. Here, Jerry, here's my address. And I gave it to him. And soon after, I kind of didn't sleep well until he died about 4 years after that. Because soon after, I started filming him, and he was out of control. And he never let me forget that he knew my address.
Yeah, he'd call you up and say, yo, you're going to work out again, aren't you?
Yeah, man, he knew my routine, and you know, like I work out once a week, and sometimes he would call me then just to remind me he knew my routine. I mean, it was devilish in a way, but he was also a great guy. It was like, it's sometimes you have to accept some really bad things about a person in order to also get their big heart. Like, McGill had a really big heart and some insights into some interesting things, but you had to put up with a lot of crap in order to get through it, and some fear. And he was a drug addict too, so there was like this wild card element at any time that he could come steal everything in your house.
It's like living in a Gus Van Sant movie or something.
Yeah, it was. It really, really, really was. And I mean, I was sorry when he died, but a little part of me was relieved. Yeah.
I thought it was telling that you're in talking about Alex Chilton, that later on he kind of drew inspiration from Chet Baker.
Yeah.
And you have Chilton, who threw away his talent willingly and with great gusto, as opposed to Baker, who kind of just let the talent slip away from him.
Gosh, you know, that's a great point. And I guess I hadn't really seen it as clearly as that till now. I didn't think about Chet's career. I was just thinking about his voice and his delivery. He's got that beautiful, soft voice that sounds so much like his trumpet tone, so much tone. The delivery is kind of, it's very casual and tossed off with great, you know, but it's all about the nuance and the space in the notes and the air. And Alex took all that, you know, he got all that and brought it into his own performance. But it's absolutely true that Chet had the makings of a fantastic career, and I guess through his addiction to heroin, he lost it all. And, you know, was still around a little bit, could perform, could record most times, but nothing like the career he could have had. And Alex, as you said, he kind of willfully threw his away with great gusto. Throwing away, though, I can't quite go with throwing away, because I think Alex thought on the records he gave the least effort to, they were still good demo songs, you know. He was always a songwriter, so his songs would get out, and he wanted them to be good enough for someone else to consider covering them.
Can you think of what did Alex Chilton want?
Steven, man, this is great. You're asking the good questions. What Alex wanted became obscured by what he didn't get, because Alex began with fame, right? The first time he goes into a recording studio.
But the second time he ever sang into a microphone, it was?
Yeah, yeah. The first time at a talent show at high school, and the second time in a recording studio, he records The Letter, Give Me a Ticket for an Airplane. It has a number one worldwide hit, right? Then he's with the Box Tops for 4 years or so, maybe about 4 years, and achieves quite a number of hits, tours all over the place, gets no money, or not, you know, nothing like the money he deserved. He and the band are completely ripped off. Finally, he walks away. He falls in with the underground scene in Memphis, and John Fry at Ardent Records records the Big Star first record, which is a beautifully crafted, artistically inspired LP, you know, just about on the par with most anything from the early 70s in the rock and roll world.
Yeah, Badfinger and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 totally. I mean, very Beatlesque in a way, but even with a little more grit. I mean, they found a great place. And the first record comes out. Ardent Records made a distribution deal with Stax Records. And the first record came out just as Stax was establishing their deal with CBS Records. So it should have been a great national connection, but the timing of the record was all wrong. It got nowhere. That whole deal between Stax and CBS fell apart. Ardent was a victim of it. And the second Big Star record comes out as that deal is tanking. So the first one never gets traction. A few other records, non-Big Star records in there, get a little life out of the relationship.
And he and Chris Bell had parted ways.
But so the point is, Alex made great records. He began by making, you know, pretty good singles that went somewhere. Then he made two great rock and roll records that I think they knew were artistic achievements, you know, and they went nowhere. And so what he wanted after that, I think, was to be able to do what he did, I guess, to be able to write songs and record them and not be told how to do it. That's what he wanted. He wanted not to be told anything.
I mean, he hit that sweet spot with Third, which I thought was just the perfect balance between the experimental weird stuff and the great pop rock,
yes,
power pop of the first two Big Star records.
Okay.
And if he could have inhabited that space a little bit longer.
So I think what happens there is that's the first time he works with Jim Dickinson as a producer. So that's a good relationship. They do it again with Like Flies on Sherbert, that gets sort of the inverse of Third. You know, it's uncontrolled sounding record, which is actually quite controlled, much harder to do than it seems. It's a great record. But after that, I don't think anyone ever produced Alex but Alex. All he did was, you know, come in and record songs that he could also perform on stage. No textural overlays, no studio experimentation, real straight. Now, some of the performances are better than others. Some are great, you know, but those songs are all real documentary style production.
Well, and then we have to talk about his involvement with one Gustavo Falco.
Yes. Yes. I love the Panther Burns. I'm, you know, I saw, I think I was at their first gig downtown at 96 South Front, and that was maybe my first introduction to punk rock. It was definitely the first time I saw anyone pogo.
That legendary TV appearance here in town, too. Oh, that is something else. Oh, man.
It is great. My friend David Leonard and I often talk about how to collect all this great Memphis archival video footage and share it with the world. But that is truly great stuff. After Tap Falcon and the Panthers play a song, then they have this amazing off-the-cuff dialogue that Marge Thrasher's dripping with disdain, and Tav is answering circles around her beautifully. Tav says, "We would like to do one more song." And Marge Thrasher says, "Gustavo, I don't think we're quite ready for that yet."
And I've started calling Tav the second best white blues man from Gurdon, Arkansas.
Because the first, well, let's see, Honey Drippers from there, isn't he Joe Liggins? But he's black.
I know.
Who's white?
Gary Floyd from The Dicks and Sister Double Happiness was born and raised in Gurdon, Arkansas.
Wow, no kidding, man.
Yeah. And so
they needed to,
and Jimmy Witherspoon is from Gurdon.
That's
too.
Who I was thinking of. Yeah. Not Liggins, yeah. Right.
And it's just 20 miles away is Delight, Arkansas, where the anti-Tav Falco, Glenn Campbell, was from.
Wow, man. They need to have a little museum down there.
So, of course, this begs for a soundtrack, and you've put one together.
Thank you. I had the same thought. You know, I've liked to do it with many of my past books. It came from Memphis. I got 3 CDs that accompany it. But here, I was actually motivated by the Alex Chilton song on there, which is recorded live on Madison, Midtown Memphis, backed by the Randy Band, playing a song that Alex knew but the band didn't. But they follow him perfectly fine for punk rock. It's called Johnny Too Bad. It's from the soundtrack to The Harder They Come. And it's not really performed in a reggae way, but Alex delivers on it. And there's this chaotic but thrilling backing. And I thought, if I can get that out, then whatever else comes out is gravy. So I worked that out. And then I realized, I think I have some old cassette recordings that I made in a couple locations. And so I include one from Junior Kimbrough's house, not his juke joint, but his house, where he used to have house parties in the mid-80s in a cotton field outside of Holly Springs, and one from Green's Lounge, where the Fieldstones played every Saturday night. Some of the deepest blues I've ever heard. Every Saturday night, totally took it for granted. Those are both on there. Half the record is previously unreleased material, and half the record is released material that you've never heard before. Including, there's a Jerry Magill track on there,
yeah,
doing Guy Clark's Desperado's Waiting on a Train with Lee Baker, the guitarist from Mudboy and the Neutrons.
And the Agitators.
And the Agitators. Lee Baker plays a guitar solo on there that is so taut and tense and tight. It blows me away.
Did you read Peter Cooper's last book about his just collection of country and western stories?
No. Peter.
He was talking about the first time he got to cover a concert was a Guy Clark show in South Carolina. And he said, in a quiet spot, in between, Guy had introduced his son. I think he was playing bass for him at the time. And this one drunk guy was out. He goes, "I wish Guy Clark was my daddy."
That's kind of cool. When I was interested in doing some work, Towns had died. And so I was up in Nashville, and I went to Guy Clark and Susanna Clark's house to interview them about Towns, because I was thinking about writing something about him. I'd spent like 2 weeks on the road with him in Europe and with Alex Chilton and some bands from here. And Towns really hit it off with the Hellcats, and he would come down here and we'd all have dance parties. They were certainly fun. I don't know that I'd want them as my parents.
Well, and Towns is another person born into wealth and threw that away to do his own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And really had a death wish. I think Guy Clark acknowledged it at the funeral. I think it's how I opened my piece. Guy Clark, as he's putting the guitar strap over his head, and it's at Towns' funeral, he says, "Well, I guess I booked this gig about 30 years ago when I met Towns."
Is Memphis special anymore, or are we just that old high school athlete who remembers the state championship game 30 years later?
I'll tell you, immediately we're special, and one of the evidences of proof is that in an age when everyone records in their bedroom or, you know, in their kitchen on a computer, on a laptop, there remain quite a number of active recording studios here. People still come here to record because of the vibe. And what the vibe is, I think, is in that same way you can sin in Vegas and not feel as bad about it as you would at home. People come to Memphis and let themselves looser than they normally would artistically. I think for one thing, they are more open to African-American song influence, whether it's gospel music or the blues. That sort of spirit is more pervasive, and I think that people are more willing to push themselves here because they feel like that's why they came here. Now I'm in Memphis. So just the belief in the vibe makes the vibe be there. And then talent-wise, I mean, look, as a guy who just released a book, I had my last film was, you know, widely received. I can't emphasize how hard it is to become a blip on the radar screen of culture these days. There's so many blips invading the radar screen. People get their culture from so many different ways. And so I think people coming here allows them to push themselves in a way that they feel like will get them, you know, will create better art. And that will make it easier to get a blip, which I think is true.
What do you think about young artists like Marco Pave and Julian Baker and Cities of Eve and folks
yes,
like that?
That's where I was going to go. I've been really enjoying the Unapologetic Collective. They've got an app, too. The guy's a great singer. His name begins with a C. There's a group of people, and it's hip-hop based, but it's all over the place. I like that too. You know, Memphis has the crossroads. All the sounds intersect here in still surprising ways. I think you see it in the Unapologetic Collective sometimes. Julianne Baker. Does anyone else sound like her?
She's the real deal.
She's the real deal. No one else sounds like her. That's why she's so cool. You know, and it's great that she's from here, and it's great that she's got an appreciation for it. And yeah, so, and I think that the whole sort of the crunk and post-crunk, you know, 3-6 mafia thing.
But like everyone's moved out of town. They've gone to Houston Atlanta.
Yeah. That doesn't stop, you know, Marco Pave or Cities of Eve or Unapologetic from doing their thing. And so when they hit, they'll be from here, not from Houston. I would bet that where are the 3-6 guys living in Houston?
Houston, I think, yeah.
So, you know.
Thank God he moved to Atlanta or something. And
even there, I would wager that they're self-identifying and being identified as Memphis musicians. Oh, Yo Gotti, you're from Memphis. Yeah, man, I love your stuff. You know, he may be living in Atlanta. The 3-6 guys may be in Houston. But because they came from here, that thing lives. Also, you know, I shouldn't say this so much because it'll bring about its demise, but this is a very livable city. I love that traffic's not bad. You know, housing is gotten expensive, but nothing like Nashville, nothing like other places. So you can come here and your dollar goes further.
That's why like Mike Doty and Anna Popovich have moved here to town. And
yeah, exactly. You know, because your dollar goes further, you can hew. I'm a hewer. I write and then I rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. I'm whittling and shaving and doing all that. And that takes time, you know. So the rent is not as pressing here as it is in other places.
Well, what do you got next on your docket? You got another movie coming out?
I have been working on one, getting one funded for 11 years, this particular movie that resurrected itself in 2015, and we thought we were going to make it that year. And practically, certainly every year since that year, since 15, I thought it was going to be next. Most every month, I thought it would happen the next month. There was a period at the end of 2017 where I was thinking it would happen the next week. So I just got off the phone earlier today, you know, and I'm not going to say what it is. It's too easy to jinx. But there's a music feature doc I'm working on. Then, you know, I do a lot of other things. I'm producing a documentary that a friend of mine's directing on Bill Drummond, who was a UK music sensation with the KLF. And the
those are some interesting fellas in the KLF.
Yeah, Bill is one of the two of them. And we shot the first half of the film a year ago in India. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be in Lexington, North Carolina, rural North Carolina, shooting the second half of that film, which is Bill doing his art, performance art, street art, public art. He kind of does mundane things in public and creates community around them. Shines shoes, bakes cake.
Did they do the song with Tammy Wynette?
Yes. Yes. Justified and Ancient, I think. Or True to the Trail. Yeah, that was Justified and Ancient. Yeah. So I got that going. Cutting a little short film right now about Dockery Farms in Mississippi, liner notes, essays, other book projects, sort of piddling along. Yeah.
So let's wrap it up with something that is tough for you. Someone says, "I admire you."
Yeah, that was really fun to address that in this thing. So the way these essays, one of the ways these essays are connected, not only by Memphis and art, is that I wrote a new introduction to each of them to give them some context. And I saw that by doing that, I was creating a sort of broad autobiography of my career. I let more personal stuff out in the intros to these pieces. And so at the end of the book, it seemed natural to address this, that as a writer, having that I've been addressed all kinds of ways. You know, I'm writing about a local cozy scene that has international interest, but it remains a coalition or a few coalitions of people here and the way they've interacted and intersected. And for that, some people are eternally thankful to me. Some people absolutely resent me because they feel like they should have been telling this story. Some people thoroughly despise me because I didn't put them in the book. Some people thoroughly despise me because I did put them in the book. A few times I've gotten things wrong, you know, and so people don't like that. And the result is that when someone comes up and says, you know, "Are you Robert Gordon, the writer?" I don't have that immediate sense of gratification. Oh, someone recognizes my work and they like it. It's more fear, you know, it's like, which, you know, yes, why? You know, oh, I just want to talk about this. Great, you know, happy to talk about it.
Well, I mean, you've chosen at least a style with enough edge.
Yes, I like
that,
an edge.
That it can get you in trouble. And I was just wondering about the very first piece in the book about Sam Phillips and the Late Night with David Letterman.
Yeah.
You refer to Robert Morton as a staffer backstage. And the next year he became executive producer of the program.
Oh, you know, so Robert Morton's got me on his list too. What can I say?
I said, that's kind of underestimating who that man was.
Yeah, it was. Okay, I'll fix it in the next printing.
All right. I want to thank you so much, Robert, for stopping by. It's been a pleasure.
Love being here, Stephen. Thank you for having me. WIPL is doing really cool things. More radio is always good for Memphis.
Robert Gordon is the author of Memphis Rent Party, the blues, rock, and soul in music's hometown, which is published by Bloomsbury USA. The soundtrack album of the same name is available on vinyl and via streaming services from Fat Possum Records. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.